Up until Ronald Reagan, for a significant part of the 20th century, there was this thing called the Fairness Doctrine. And I think there's still open debate about what consequences that really had. But it seems pretty clear when it was removed during the Reagan administration, I think it was like 1987, almost immediately after that, the media landscape changed. And maybe there's other reasons for it, but it seems like that was a pretty big reason for the rise of somebody like Rush Limbaugh and subsequently commentators on Fox News and so forth. But I think that Rush Limbaugh frequently credited himself for saving the institution of AM radio. I grew up in the rural parts of the country, and in many areas out there in Nebraska and South Dakota, AM radio stations that carried Rush Limbaugh's program throughout the week were like the only things that you could get on the radio. It seems clear to me that that has had a pretty direct effect on the polarization and the kind of ideological spectrum that we observe today.
You're making me wonder. I think it's possible that some of the arguments that claim that the GOP today is the party of Trump, that those claims might be overstated to the extent that you have these earlier precedents, in particular interventions in the conservative media sphere, that really created a condition of possibility for the rise of figures like Sarah Palin and figures like Donald Trump, too, that there's a certain specific media appeal and media resonance that is capitalized by all of those figures. And maybe you could say it started with Rush Limbaugh and a kind of turn in the Republican Party in the early 90s after George H.W. Bush failed to win re-election and Bill Clinton was inaugurated. And in that span, that's right when Rush Limbaugh comes to prominence, right? As a kind of backlash movement. And American politics is all about backlash and counter-backlash and counter-counter-backlash. This program is pandemic politics, but we might as well be pendular politics. That's the American ethos. And you can just see, like, the Newt Gingrich, right? When he became Speaker of the House, how he also incorporated and empowered the Rush Limbaugh message because he saw that it had the power to turn out unlikely voters who aren't captured well by polls, unlikely voters who have a set of grievances tied to their geographic location, sometimes their ethnic identity, sometimes their socioeconomic status. And that, I think, has been successful for the GOP in many states. And now, with Trump having lost re-election in 2020, it begs the question, to what extent will the GOP need to reinvent itself? And really, that's where we find ourselves. And to me, that's the context in which the potential censure of Senator Murkowski makes sense, because she voted to convict, she voted guilty on the impeachment charges in Donald Trump's Senate trial. And it's not just about Trump, right? Her voting that way, it's also a vote for taking the party in a new direction. And a number of other GOP senators obviously agreed with her that a new direction would be strategic for the Republican Party. But I saw some numbers today, actually. New poll is out that just polled Republicans, and there was an exact split between those who said they were Trump Republicans versus those who said they were non-Trump Republicans. I mean, evenly divided. We've been thinking about this and looking at empirical data around this question and really just recognizing the extent to which it's framing up our whole moment, right? All of our politics right now seem to revolve around this question of what does the future look like for the Republican Party, if the future is viable for that party, what would it include? And to me, that's how we have to understand the censure, right? I mean, some of our state legislators in Alaska, what is it, five districts, Nate, have argued that a censure would be appropriate for Murkowski, given that she voted to convict. But as Robert was saying earlier, censure is a non-binding thing. It's symbolic. It's a public declaration of disagreement, which has no legal effect.
Yeah, it gets at something that I think it's important to talk about. And I think it even gets to theories about what representative democracy really is and what it means. And so, you've got Alaska included, you've got these states, I think most at this point of the states that have Republican senators that voted to convict have at least made these gestures toward rebuking those senators. Alaska's one, North Carolina's one, Richard Burr, and Pennsylvania in particular. And there's this quote, which has been in the news, and I just think it's worth mentioning. It's the Washington County, Pennsylvania Republican chair. And he said, in part, he said this. He said, "We did not send him there," referring to Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey, who voted to convict. Ball said, "We did not send Toomey there to vote his conscience. We did not send him there to do the right thing or whatever he said he was doing. We sent him there to represent us." Okay. That's just remarkable. And I think that to me, the reason that that's remarkable, the core issue there, is that we rarely get such a distilled and pure version of what I think is this difference between ideas of the delegate model for representation versus the trustee model for representation. And I think Edmund Burke was the most erudite proponent of the idea of trustee model, where you elect somebody, like voters get together and elect somebody to go and represent them in parliament or in the federal government. But once that person's there, they are free and actually directed to use their own judgment about issues. And the implicit understanding is that the public recognizes that they have access to information that constituents in the public doesn't always have. They are good at forming and maintaining relationships with other people in the government that are useful and that are beneficial to their constituents. That's, again, that's opposed to this idea of like a delegate model where it's, okay, we're going to send our representative to the legislature, but that person is there to reflect the will of the people. That person is there to reflect the identity and the preferences and the judgment of the people that put them there. And if an issue comes up where this individual thinks that they feel differently than their constituents, they have to side with their constituents. And this GOP chair, this county GOP chair in Pennsylvania, seems like he's very clearly saying that for Senator Toomey, he should be very much more on the delegate side of that discrepancy. Is that accurate? I know that that's like political theory, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, I would even zoom out even farther and connect some of what we're seeing now in terms of the potential Murkowski Center or other potential centers that are happening in other similar states, right, like in Pennsylvania. I'll connect it to this broader question. What are state legislatures for? What is the function that is distinctive to their body? And what justifies the founding of a civics association ever? What would justify the existence of government more generally? You can look at the Alaska State Constitution talks about this in very clearly classical liberal terms, right? I mean, classical liberals like Hobbes, like Locke, Rousseau, they all give the same answer. There's only one thing that can truly legitimize the founding of a civic association, which is to say of a state that monopolizes political power. There's only one thing that can justify that, and that's the creation of freedom. The next question is always, well, what do you mean by that? Hobbes said that freedom basically is freedom from fear, freedom from the fear that arises out of recognition that in the quote-unquote state of nature, everyone has an equal right to do whatever they want. The only thing that limits their will is the quantity of force that they possess. And in a world like that, it's like a Cormac McCarthy novel or something, right? A world like that, no one can quite be free because you're always fearful. And so for him, the whole point of having a government, having a state that monopolizes political power is to ensure that there's a check against people's more malicious intents so that we can be free from other people, basically, free from other people's ability to do whatever they want. So it's freedom from fear. So the whole point is to create stability and safety. And obedience to the law is what creates safety, and safety is freedom. That's Hobbes. Locke said some of that is right and some of that is not right. Really, the point of the government is to protect private property. Only when private property is protected and when we have a right to private property can we be free, because freedom is about freedom from the inconveniences that arise in a world where everyone is an equal judge of everyone else. So the point is to create a state and then to allow that state to monopolize not just political power and force, but the right to judge when things are right or wrong, and in particular around private property disputes. But Rousseau is the classical liberal that gets us to the point that you're making now, because Rousseau said all that is kind of incorrect. What legitimizes a civic form of association is, again, yes, freedom, the creation of freedom. Once we have a state, we can have freedom. But he defined freedom not in terms of freedom from fear and not in terms of freedom from, I guess, theft, but rather he said a free society is one in which the general will is exalted. He said this, and this gets right to your quote. He said that the general will is whatever is truly objectively in the common good, not what people say or think the common good consists in, but what it actually is. And so a state that can maximize and enable and guarantee that common good is a legitimate one, which is to say, is a state that can create a context where freedom can be meaningful for everyone, for citizens who live within that environment. But he goes on and on and on in his treatise on the social contract about this point that the general will is not the same thing as the sum of all wills. Your quote about there's a difference between electing an official who's going to represent you versus electing an official who's going to do the right thing. Yeah. It's also about the difference between what people think is important to do and what is actually important to do or what is actually right to do. There's the subjective and the objective as concerning what is commonly held to be right.
Well, and in the United States, at least like presently up until this point, I think there's generally been at least an implicit understanding that there can't be any pure form of either one of those things. You can't be purely delegate representative system. And you also have to be responsible to take the temperature of your constituency and to really try and accurately represent what the best case is for your constituents, even though you think that that might not line up with your own personal feelings on, you know, a particular issue. And so, you know, there's this kind of middle ground that's like, I think it's called like the Politico representative model. There are some issues where the public just doesn't have access to all the information, you know, on like budget allocations or how much support a particular program gets or this and that. It's actually hard for me to understand how a purely delegate model would even work. I mean, are you like constantly polling the public on every single issue that's like up for debate and decision-making? There are a few issues. There are a handful, I think, of issues in the present day in our political world in the United States where it does seem like in order to behave responsibly as an elected official, you should treat those like they are delegate issues. Okay, if you're a Republican, perhaps trying to limit and restrict abortion is kind of a delegate issue. And so even though you might feel one way about it, you might vote a different way because you're elected as a Republican, you're elected to represent a particular constituency, and you know that how that constituency feels about it. But I guess I would say, like, especially in an environment as polarized as we are, even that, I think, is kind of like tricky to consider, because in Alaska, you've probably got a lot of people that are upset that things like abortion is legal and recreational use of marijuana is legal. So they consider that a problem, okay? And so we elect Republican representatives to the state government, to the federal government, who agree with the folks that think that those things, those social freedoms are problems. But if you were going to poll the whole state on issues like that, which has happened via ballot initiatives, actually, the majority of people say that they want to maintain those freedoms, those social freedoms. And so it's hard to even understand what are the issues that are even delegate issues. Maybe this Pennsylvania GOP chair is suggesting that support of Donald Trump has become a delegate issue, has become like a purity test and a defining issue for the Republican Party. And if you don't support, if you're not going to vote to acquit Donald Trump, no matter what he does, then you don't belong in the Republican Party, and we're going to censure you, and we're going to condemn your work, and we're going to try and elect somebody else.
Yeah. You know, this difference between the delegate model and the trustee model of representation that you're describing reminds me of actually what Lisa Murkowski's public response has been to the specter of censure. She said this: if I can't say what I believe that our president should stand for, then why should I ask Alaskans to stand with me? I can't allow the significance of my vote to be devalued by whether or not I feel that this is helpful for my political ambition. So you can see her there arguing, I mean, she's making an argument about her relationship to the censure charge, but there's also a broader argument there about what political leadership requires, right? Sometimes going out on a limb, sometimes making decisions that are unpopular within your own party, that's actually required of someone who's in a leadership position is what she's saying. So just the opposite. Loyalty to the party ought not to be the bellwether for leadership. There should be other metrics is what she appears to be saying. Now, it occurs to me that actually, if the state Republican Party in Alaska decides to censure her, it's potentially a risky move in light of the ranked choice voting system that we now have in place. They might be falling right into her hands, right? That might actually guarantee her reelection. If she can position herself relative to the Republican Party in this way, it might actually be a gain for her. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, you mentioned pendulum politics. This is kind of polarity politics. This is like the polarity politics that we've talked about vis-a-vis ranked choice voting in Alaska, where precisely because she's angering or provoking maybe not through her own intention, but maybe just through her, what she thinks is responsible way to act, that is angering people to her right. And that very reaction could engender support from the middle or even from the left for her. And you're right that in like in an open primary, which we will have in next year when she's running for re-election. It's also worth noting, I guess, that she's the only Republican senator that is up for re-election who voted to convict for impeachment. I think that's like an interesting point and a relevant point. But yeah, in an open primary, I think that she stands a good chance of securing more support from people to her, what we would probably call people to her left and to the Republican Party's left, if she's doing things that appear independent and don't appear to be sycophantic to Trump and to his legacy.
Nate Bauer directs the University of Alaska Press, and Alexander Hirsch teaches political science at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm Robert Hannon.